Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest,
Hello, I'm Richard Walker. Welcome to Network Europe. Coming up on the programme, the French government's got new plans for housing the homeless. Put them in trailer parks. We ask if it'll solve the problem.
If no one finds them a job, or if nothing is done to help them reintegrate into society, it's not going to work. Because it's like giving them a hotel, paying their hotel nights, and allowing them to watch time go by.
The Netherlands looks back at the world's worst air disaster 30 years ago. Germans celebrate 50 years of the Trabant car. Well, those who aren't broken down in a lay-by. And Britain's marking 200 years of no slavery, but progressive old Sweden had slavery too, and took even longer to abolish it. Keeping history alive, we hear from Stockholm, plus the highs and lows of the week in Brussels from our correspondent in the Belgian capital. All of that and a bit more coming up on this week's edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters. This week coming to you from our studios in Hilversum, Holland. And we start the programme with a topsy-turvy week for the European Union. Still high on subsidised booze, nightclubbing and a general spirit of self-congratulation from the Treaty of Rome celebrations in Berlin last week, European heads of state were declaring the future's bright for everyone concerned. But they'd hardly finished letting all the migrant workers clean up the mess when scandal struck and the European Commission had to fend off accusations of corruption. I suggested to Network Europe's Brussels correspondent, Stephen Castle, that our EU leaders had probably hoped for better this week.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think this is probably the last thing that EU officials wanted. They've just spent a weekend celebrating the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome in Berlin. The festivities were based. They've come back and almost immediately they're plunged into a corruption scandal. Three people, all of Italian nationality, have been arrested. It doesn't appear to me that this is of a massive scale, this scandal. Certainly at present, or things may emerge in the future. The problem, of course, is that it just reminds people of difficulties in the past, in particular of that famous episode back in 1999 when the entire European Commission had to quit.
But nonetheless, it was a pretty successful 50th anniversary. I wonder if the EU is now as popular as it wants itself to be.
Well, I don't think the EU will ever be as popular as it wants to be. I think you're right. It was quite a successful anniversary, 50th anniversary party, all sorts of events. There was, of course, the famous football match in England. There were the celebrations galore in Berlin, fireworks, and indeed there was a pop concert, and the city's nightclubs, 27 of them, representing each member state, one for each member state, were opened on a special concessionary price. It all appeared very successful. I have to confess that I did check out some of the nightclubs. And
which one did you go to?
To the ones representing Italy, the Czech Republic and Finland.
Did you notice any big cultural differences between them?
Well, they, in fact, all seem to be filled with more or less the same people. And I would say probably the Finnish was the best of the ones that I went to. Some of my colleagues went to the British one, and apparently it wasn't much good. All I would report is that basically people seem to be enjoying themselves and having a good time on the 50th anniversary. Now, whether enjoying yourself in a nightclub transfers to a tremendous loyalty towards the European Union remains very much to be seen.
Yes, drink for your country, support the EU. Now, one thing that has made the EU perhaps less popular has been Turkey's application and efforts to join the EU at some stage in the future. And I believe Turkey this week is starting a new area of negotiation to set that going.
That's right. The whole issue of Turkey looms in the background. Indeed, it does over the discussions about whether to revive the European Constitution, because it's been made clear by several countries, including Germany, that there's going to be no more enlargement of the EU. And until and unless there's some form of reform of the EU's structures of the kind that was envisaged in the European Constitution, and that, of course, has now been laid on one side because of referendum no votes in France and the Netherlands. So Turkey is very much at the back of people's minds. And indeed, many people, I think, would like to see no movement on Turkish accession negotiations. These are the lengthy discussions that every country country has to engage in if it wants to join the EU. But although some of these talks have been frozen, were frozen last year, the EU has given a signal this week that not all of them are going to be frozen. They've started negotiations on industry and enterprise. It's a non-controversial part of the negotiations. But I think the significance is that these discussions have started at all.
So on the whole, does the EU seem emboldened this week or slightly flattened or dampened down?
Well, I think it's a little bit two steps forward, one step back, really. We've had these great 50th anniversary celebrations, but then the gloss came off with these allegations of fraud and corruption in the European Commission, presenting the negative face of what people regard as the normal life in Europe. So I think it's back to life and back to reality, really.
Back to life, back to reality, back to life, back to reality.
Well, it's back to a sort of shifting reality if you're homeless, French and living in Paris. The French government's come up with a new idea to sort out the country's homeless problem. All through last winter, people of no fixed abode lived in tents along the banks of the trendy Canal Saint-Martin area of Paris, which you might remember from the whimsical hit movie Amelie. Well, a lucky few have now been rehoused in a trailer park south of Paris, paid for by the state. The trailer park's being called the Village of Hope. Residents are expected to use their time there to find jobs and reintegrate into society. It's an experimental project, and if it proves successful, 100 other trailer parks, I mean Villages of Hope, will be built throughout the country. Radio France International's Nick Champeau has a story from Paris.
Là, on est chez Hervé et Manu. Bon, ils sont sortis pour le moment. Là, c'est leur salle de bain. Vous avez une douche.
Jacques Dereau, the founder of the Village of Hope and a former homeless person himself, describing one of the 40 square meter trailers. These include two small bedrooms, a fully equipped kitchen, a living room and a bathroom. Marie is quite moved. She has just arrived.
Je pense que c'est le rêve un peu de tout le monde.
I think it's the dream of all the homeless people. It's better to have a real roof than to sleep in a tent by the expressway. This is going to help me start a new life. I will be able to take time to reflect. I can now store my personal belongings on shelves. That alone is a lot for people like us.
C'est déjà beaucoup pour des gens comme nous.
Jacques Dereau has been working on the Village of Hope concept for 18 years. He says emergency shelters that are only open at night are not appropriate for homeless people.
Il y a une passerelle entre la rue et le logement.
This village is like a transition, a halfway house between sleeping in the streets and living in a real house. I really believe that comfort is the key. Because I've had enough of these overcrowded emergency shelters, how can you ask people to rebuild their lives in a place where they don't want to live? How can you ask people to think about tomorrow when they haven't yet repaired their past?
Pets and alcoholic beverages are allowed. Five social workers will stay in the village full-time to help tenants find jobs, but also to remind them hygiene rules and teach them how to cook. Tenants will have to pay a symbolic rent.
They're going to have to pay the rent, 90 euros. The washing machine is going to be free, but they will have to use tokens to get it to run. People here must learn what real life is about. We are also planning to organize cultural events. We'd like to invite all of the people who live in the streets around here for a big barbecue. I know that people here don't like us much, but we're going to write some kind of open love letter, and I'm sure we're going to get along fine in the end.
Mais on va essayer de faire une grande déclaration d'amour à tout le monde pour qu'on s'aime à la fin.
Neighbors have mixed views on the project. André is a bit skeptical.
Je pense qu'avec ce, entre guillemets, si on peut dire ce genre de clientèle.
I think that we're going to have problems with this kind of clientele. Personally, I think these people are outlaws. Okay, they're lost and confused, but it's all nice to give them trailers. But after, if no one finds them a job, or if nothing is done to help them reintegrate into society, it's not going to work. Because it's like giving them a hotel, paying their hotel nights, and allowing them to watch time go by. This is not going to work.
Nick Champeau, RFI, Paris.
Oh!
from an idea that may not work to a German car that's famous for not working. To many, of course, Germany's the home of the high-performance car, BMWs and Mercedes, bombing up the autobahns. But don't forget the Trabi, or Trabant, the small two-cylinder East German Cold War car with no heater. It looked like a cross between a golf cart and a bumper car, and the GDR produced it for three decades. It's even gained cult status in today's unified Germany, and this year the car turns 50, and some will be fondly celebrating. Kyle James has this report from Berlin.
An old television ad by the Trabant's maker, the Sachsenring Automobilwerks in East Germany, shows four men in white jumpsuits and helmets squeezing into a little white Trabant.
Viel Raum für Ihr Gepäck.
A lot of room for your luggage, the ad says.
Wendig.
The Trabant is agile.
Schnell.
Fast.
Ausdauernd und robust.
Long-lasting and robust.
Ihr zuverlässiger Begleiter,
your dependable companion, the new Trabant 601. So, a little history's in order. The first car rolled off the factory floor in 1957, 50 years ago. It was actually never really intended to be a car. It was planned as a three-wheeled motorcycle. The designers only expected production to last for about 10 years. It ended up lasting 34. It delivered all of 25 horsepower and took a full 21 seconds to get from 0 to 60, or 0 to 100 kilometers per hour. Its top speed, 112 kilometers per hour on a good day, or about 70 miles per hour. And the Trabant's a little thing, just under 140 inches long, about 59 inches wide and 57 inches tall. In today's world of Hummers and other sports utility vehicles, it's a real shrimp. While it had a steel frame, the body was made of something called duroplast. It's a form of hardened plastic made of cotton waste from Russia and resins from the East German dye industry. In one respect, the Trabi was environmentally friendly, since its body was made of recycled materials, even though that motor spewed out large amounts of exhaust and generally stank up the place.
Because it has a real nostalgic value, and because it is a real bad car.
Johannes Drexler is a tour guide for Trabi Safari, a company in Berlin that allows people to see the city's sights from the vantage point of the little microcar. One group from Holland is just squeezed into a Trabi, camera clicking away. They're heading off to see the town and likely attract some attention along the way. Maybe you could call the Trabi a forerunner of today's Mini Cooper, although back in its day, there wasn't much trendy about it.
Well, it was the average car that people would have in East Germany. Everybody tried to afford a Trabant during the East German times. You had to wait for the Trabant a very long time. If you wanted to have a car like this, you had to have yourself put on a list and you had to wait for the car between 11 and 15 years, which was quite, outrageous.
That waiting period led to an interesting phenomenon. The Trabi was probably one of the few cars was actually more expensive to buy used than it was new. A new Trabi could set you back between 8,500 and 12,500 East German marks. For a used car, which you could get much faster, you could pay as much as 4,000 more. Again, Johannes Drexler.
To have a car in East Germany was considered to be pure luxury. Not like us here. Everybody has a car, no big deal. But in East Germany, everybody was really happy if they had some kind of ability to move around.
The Trabi plant in the city of Zwickau churned out around 3.7 million of the cars in 34 years. Today, there are still about 58,000 Trabis in use in Germany. But it isn't easy being a Trabi. The love-hate relationship with the car, even back in East Germany, led to a whole industry of Trabi jokes. They're usually centered around its size, its engine, or the quality of its materials. Here's one.
What kind of thing you need to measure the acceleration of the car?
I don't know.
A calendar.
But what finally might spell the end of the Trabi, at least on the roads, is not ridicule or a lack of replacement parts. It could be growing concerns about the environment. Trabis are not the greenest cars going. In several cities in Germany, restrictions are being put in place that would prohibit cars from entering city centers if they don't meet certain environmental standards, and the Trabis don't. But love it or hate it, the Trabi always gets noticed. Sometimes it causes laughter, sometimes a groan, sometimes a tear of nostalgia. But it almost never causes indifference. And can you say that about many cars today? Happy birthday, Trabi. For Deutsche Welle Radio, I'm Kyle James in Berlin.
There's no possible link from the rusty old Trabi to this, is there? Only that they're both having commemorative years this year, and so more than enough for me to put them together in the programme. 70 years ago this week, Polish composer Karol Szymanowski died, and it's also 125 years since he was born. Polish parliaments declared 2007 the Szymanowski year, and numerous events celebrating his music are planned over the coming months. Michael Kubicki of Polish Radio's External Service.
At the beginning of the 20th century, when Szymanowski's career started, Poland was a country under foreign rule for over 100 years. It was a cultural backwater, and it was Karol Szymanowski who gave Polish music a new lease of life at the time and brought it into the mainstream of European trends. Music critic Andrzej Sułek.
Szymanowski was the most prominent personality in Polish musical life of the first half of 20th century. What's, I think, very important, it's that that Szymanowski had several periods, stylistic periods in his life. On the very beginning, he composed music after Chopin. Then he tried to make some connotations with German composers like Strauss. Then he paid his attention to impressionist, to expressionist, and at the very end of his life, he found his own very personal path, artistic path. I mean, his national period, when he took a lot, borrowed a lot from folklore, from music of Polish mountaineers.
Szymanowski's ballet, Harnasie, inspired by Polish highland folklore, was premiered in Paris in 1933 and has had about 30 productions since. The opera King Roger, which is the fruit of the composer's fascination with Oriental culture, has had over 20 productions, two of which, in Italy and Germany, were by Poland's famous film director Krzysztof Zanussi.
Szymanowski is one of these great composers who was a little bit overshadowed by changes that happened in the late 30s and 40s in music, but his place should be really preserved for him, and I deeply believe that Poland should make more effort to promote him.
Andrzej Sułek agrees that Szymanowski's music deserves a much wider international recognition.
Even if we find some influences of Western music, of European music in his output, it's always very individual and it's recognizable, I would say. And I think this 2007 year is a good moment to promote his output in a proper way.
A revival of interest in Szymanowski's music began several years ago. The opera King Roger, the violin concerto and songs have been recorded by famous performers and top labels. Simon Rattle is probably the leading promoter of Szymanowski outside Poland. Numerous events promoting Szymanowski's music are scheduled for this year around the world. For Network Europe, I'm Michał Kubicki in Warsaw.
Now, this is a programme chock full of commemorations, and here's another one for you. It's 200 years since Great Britain abolished the slave trade. but there were countries which, instead of following this fine example, took advantage of it and expanded their transatlantic slave operations. One of those, you might be surprised to hear, was Sweden. It didn't abandon the practice until nearly 40 years later. But how much do the Swedes of today know about their country's rather shameful past? Radio Sweden's Tom McCallenden finds out.
England, Portugal, France, Spain, Holland, European countries that are well known for being involved in trading slaves from Africa in and around the Atlantic up until the 19th century. But like its southern neighbour Denmark, historians say Sweden too profited from slavery. And according to Professor Dick Harrison from Lund University, in the 17th century, Sweden even paved the way for what was to come, as most of the other countries involved in slave trading hadn't yet begun to develop big slave ship fleets.
It began in the 1630s and the 1640s when every European nation wanted to get involved in the triangular trade and the East Asian trade and to get rich by all these new ships and the new maritime routes. And Swedish investors and Dutch investors and various investors who were connected to the Kingdom of Sweden decided to get into this trade. At that time, they had no idea it was going to be slave trade. They wanted gold, they wanted ivory, they wanted sugar, and so on. And after four or five voyages, which were hugely profitable, they realized that the slave trade could be one of the main avenues to great profits.
But it didn't stop there. After that first wave, Sweden's involvement in the slave trade was relatively small. But a new phase began in the late 18th century when the Swedish king, Gustav III, bought the West Indian island San Barthélemy from the French. He soon decided to turn it into a Swedish slave colony.
At that time, the island of San Barthélemy was hardly populated at all. There were about 700 or 800 individuals, white individuals. There were about 700 slaves. It was a very small colony. 10 or 15 years later, there were thousands of inhabitants there. A completely new island capital had been built by slave labor, and thousands of slaves had been imported and were continually imported and re-exported. Because this was the Napoleonic era, with everybody in war with everybody, so that this Swedish island could serve as a free trade basis and the basis for slave trading and smuggling to the entire West Indies. And as such, the Swedish king and the Swedish investors made huge profits and would probably have continued to do so if the Napoleonic Wars hadn't ended in 1815.
Dick Harrison says neither of the two waves were important for the economy on a national scale, but trafficking slaves across the Atlantic was a matter of national pride in Sweden, and even the church had no problem with it.
Most Swedes believe that slavery was abolished in Sweden in the 14th century, in 1335 or something like that. Actually, it was forbidden by the Swedish Riksdag, the Swedish Parliament, as late as in 1845. 1845, and it was abolished in practice in 1848. The reason for that is that most of the Swedish politicians of every estate, peasants, burghers, nobility, and most importantly, the clergy, they were very much in favour of slavery. It was a natural thing.
It might have been about keeping up appearances then, but there's been plenty of denial ever since. Today, it's hard to find many Swedes who actually know their country was a slave trading nation as late as the 19th century. But it's probably not surprising, as you won't find it in many history books. Musician Amadou Ja performing at a seminar in Stockholm on Sweden's role in transatlantic slave trading. One of the speakers was Victoria Kawesa from the Centre Against Racism in Stockholm. She thinks Sweden needs to recognise its role in slavery to help in the fight against racism today.
Sweden is denying that they took part. They don't want to talk about it. They want to forget about it. And reminding Sweden that they took part in slavery is to show them that the state has accountability for today, because there are people today who are subjected to racism and discrimination, and this has roots in slavery and the slave trade.
Katimbra Sabuni from the African Swedish National Association agrees that Sweden needs to start facing up to its past.
In Sweden, we are very proud of our history as a beacon of human rights all around the world. So we wouldn't like to tarnish that reputation by looking at our own history and looking at our own backyard and some of the things we have done here. We do not tell it because it wouldn't be convenient to tell it. I mean, the hypocrisy is just too much.
You're listening to Network Europe. Thirty years ago, two planes collided at Los Rodeos Airport in Tenerife, killing 583 passengers and crew. It remains the worst air crash in aviation history. A Dutch KLM jumbo jet loaded with holidaymakers crashed into another 747, a Pan American flight, on the runway in heavy fog. 61 passengers escaped from the Pan Am flight. There were no survivors from the KLM plane. Bad communication between the Dutch pilot and air traffic control was ultimately blamed for the accident. At a moving ceremony, more than 500 next of kin and rescue workers gathered to commemorate the tragedy. Karen Tafuri spoke on behalf of the American victims, giving one of many personal stories, and Radio Netherlands went along to listen to them.
It is so hard to believe that it happened 30 years ago today. On March 27th, 1977. I could not believe what I was seeing. The coverage was of nothing but total chaos, death and destruction surrounding the collision of two fully loaded 747 jumbo jets on a fog-filled runway in the Canary Islands. My emotions ran from total shock to extreme sadness to confusion and uncertainty of it all, because the tragedy happened at the wrong place, at the wrong airport, and it was too late in the day for me to think that it could possibly involve a member of my family. The next day, I was hopeful that of the 61 survivors, we would be blessed, but unfortunately, we were not.
583 lives were lost. These losses have not been forgotten, nor were they in vain. As a consequence of this terrible disaster, aviation laws and regulations were changed, and cockpit voice protocols and procedures were upgraded and standardized. Untold lives have been saved by these transformative measures. But of course, such advances don't necessarily ease the very real and very personal pain of such a tremendous loss.
I would especially like to thank those who came to the rescue of all those in need after the mishap. From what I have read, the spirit of the Tenerife people welled up for the survivors and for the victims.
American Ambassador to Spain Eduardo Aguirre and Karen Tafuri speaking at the Tenerife Air Crash Memorial Service there. Well, that's it for this week's Network Europe. The programme will be back next week, of course, coming to you from my colleagues in Bonn in Germany. Until then, it's goodbye from me, Richard Walker, here in Hilversum. Network Europe is a partnership of Radio Netherlands, Deutsche Welle, Radio Sweden, Radio France International, Radio Romania, Radio Slovakia, Radio Slovenia, Radio Prague, Polish Radio External Services, and Radio Bulgaria. And I leave you with the sound of punk meeting High Camp in 1979. Adam and the Ants. Cool, those were the days.